And good afternoon to all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at CJTR. A little different opening song there. That's the Old Crow Medicine Show singing a Woody Guthrie tune, Sticking to the Union. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International Volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. My name's Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm joined by our co-host Mona Hill, and today is the 62nd. Got it? Anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We have with us Kara Banks, Executive Assistant to the Saskatchewan Federation of Labor, and Larry Kowalchuk, a lawyer for the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, RWDSU. They're here to talk about the Sask Federation of Labor's Labor Rights Are Human Rights campaign. Good afternoon to the both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
I was being a little cute there with the 62nd anniversary, because for some reason or other we had a little discussion about whether it was the 62nd or the 61st anniversary. But anyway, I won't go into that.
And you're right, Jim. It was the 62nd.
I was right.
Oh. Welcome, everybody.
You want to treasure that moment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's carved in stone on public radio.
It doesn't
you're right.
Doesn't happen often, so let me enjoy it here.
So welcome to the show, everybody. Today is a very special day in history, and it is the 62nd anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and today is Human Rights Day. I'm going to give you a little bit of background on Human Rights Day, then we're going to talk to Larry and Kara. First of all, for those of you who don't know, the development of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights began in 1945, and Eleanor Roosevelt played a critical role and was responsible for bringing together and guiding a complex international team that comprised of female and male philosophers, lawyers, politicians, diplomats, and trade unionists to work on the development of the Declaration. And what is frequently left out of this story is the role of trade unions. In the midst of the current recession, with growing inequality, stagnant wages, unacceptably high unemployment, and union membership hovering at just 12% of the workforce, today seems a fitting time to review labor's role in securing workers' rights as fundamental human rights. And to start, as a syndicated columnist, Eleanor Roosevelt was herself a union member with the American Newspaper Guild. Labor had a long history of engagement on international issues and was part of the discussion about the United Nations early on. Three of the seven NGOs that were included in the responsibility for drafting the charter were labor organizations, including the Photo Engravers Union, the World Federation of Trade Unions, and the International Confederation of Christian Trade Unions based in Europe. Roosevelt noted in her May Day column, "It is natural, of course, that labor unions should be interested in human rights. And one of the things that I hope will evolve from any bill of this kind is the right of people to economic as well as political freedom." Strong arguments for the specific inclusion of trade union rights in the document included the closed shop and the right to strike. Eleanor Roosevelt explained that the United States delegation considered that the right to form and join trade unions was an essential element of freedom. After months of deliberation, the General Assembly passed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on December 10th with 48 votes in favor and none against. It is worth reading and reflecting on Article 23. Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. Everyone, without any discrimination, has the right to equal pay for equal work. Everyone who works has the right to just and favorable remuneration, ensuring for himself and his family, and today I'm going to insert herself and her family, an existence worthy of human dignity and supplemented, if necessary, by other means of social protection. And number four, everyone has the right to form and to join trade unions for the protection of his, and I will insert, or her interests. So let's move on and talk with Larry and Kara about the project that they have. Go for it. It's your show.
Okay, well, I work at the Federation of Labor, as you explained, and one of our jobs as a labor central of 37 affiliated unions in the province is to be a bit of a watchdog on what our governments are doing. And so we've been paying pretty close attention to the laws that they've passed here in the province since they were elected in 2007. And what we find is a disturbing pattern where labor rights are being rolled back and violated, and other human rights as well. So I guess we sort of began our campaign right shortly after the 2007 election, when the Wall government introduced Bills 5 and 6, and those are the Public Service Essential Services Act and the amendments to the Trade Union Act. And we studied those laws very carefully. We raised a number of issues about the content of them, but actually, fundamentally, one of our biggest concerns was that the government didn't consult anyone at all before they introduced them. And they held a little bit of a so-called feedback session, you know, before they actually rammed them through. And so we have raised a lot of concerns. And since then, we've been kind of going on the road and talking to workers about what these laws mean. And we've also embarked on a number of legal initiatives to actually challenge them, which I would let Larry talk about as the lawyer on the file.
I will talk about that as a lawyer on the file, but first of all, I want to say thank you for the invitation to be here on this day, because it gives us a chance to reveal to people something about the labor movement that people tend to forget.
And what is that?
People think that unions are all about their own self-interest. They go on strike just to get better wages, and that's all they're concerned about. They're only concerned about that issue. And as you pointed out, that's not what unions are all about. In Saskatchewan in particular, the labor movement has fundamentally been part of the fabric of building a culture of respect for people and human rights in every aspect of their lives. Medicare, healthcare, education, social services, and in fact, actually having laws that protect the human rights, not of, you know, a union member, but the human rights of every citizen in Saskatchewan. And so it's appropriate on this day to remind people that this is what unions are, and they're not self-serving. This government, as Kara was explaining, has embarked on, since its day one, this campaign to undermine, weaken, and in essence destroy the ability of working people to get together collectively and form unions and operate in unions. And some people think, well, that's good because they're a bunch of selfish people. It's, you know, stuff like that. But what's really going on here?
Well, and that was going to be one of my questions too, Larry, is there always seems to be an undercurrent of fear when you talk about unions coming from non-union people.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'd like you to kind of explore that if you can at some point during this conversation.
Well, I'm sure Kara can explain that better. But what I was going to say is that in our society right now, particularly with the right-wing governments that believe in the market system, they're getting rid of all of the support systems for all the advocacy groups. There's only one organization of people left that aren't dependent on the kindness of government in order to be able to exist, and that's unions. And so their targeting unions isn't about going after unions for their economic self-interest. They're targeting the labor movement because if they succeed, there'll be nobody left to advocate for social change and to support the fight for equal pay and equality and anti-discrimination and so on, because that's what we're about. So this is a very important day to us. Why do people fear unions, Kara?
Well, I think that what people actually fear are employers. And I think they fear being intimidated by their employer, and they fear the kind of control that ultimately employers have in a capitalist system, which is they can take away your livelihood, right?
Right.
So we are dependent. We are dependent on, you know, that paycheck. And so when people start talking union, they're nervous that there'll be repercussions, and with good reason, because employers consistently will discipline, fire, punish people who try to organize a union. So the fear is not about unions themselves. The fear is about the reprisal that they might get from employers who don't want to see a union in their workplace. So, I mean, that's part of it. I think, too, that unions do get a bad rap a lot because working people in unions don't control the media. We have some great forms of alternative media, but we don't control the mainstream media, right? And we get a bad reputation, and it's so easy to keep repeating those things like, oh, they're just in it for themselves, and it's just about their collective agreement, whatever. That's easy to say over and over, right? What's harder to do is to get out the real history of unions and some of the real functions that Larry was talking about that they do. I mean, they don't just historically use their right to strike, you know, for a better collective agreement, right? They've also used their right to strike to improve laws, right? And to eventually create programs that benefit everyone, not just people in a union. So things like employment insurance and pensions and all those things, that was working people that fought for those, right? And sometimes they did it through a union. Sometimes they were joined by their non-union brothers and sisters to make the change happen. But they needed the right to strike to do it, and they needed the right to collectively bargain to do it, right? They needed that framework where they could sit down across the table from an employer and make proposals and hammer out deals. Because, you know, there isn't an employer in the world who's just going to hand it over without being asked, right? Or without some pressure. It's just not the way our system is built.
That's not the way Walmart... I thought Walmart loves unions. You can just go and say, hey, treat me with more respect and you'll get it.
Yeah, it just doesn't work that way. That's not, you know, we do live in a hierarchical system. That's just the reality. So, you know, we need this ability to pressure. So when these laws were passed, these labor laws, you know, that basically make it next to impossible to form a union in a place where there isn't one already, and which really tie the hands of already unionized people to get, you know, good, fair deals.
How does that happen? Sorry to interrupt, but how does that happen where a law can be passed that can prevent the formation of a union?
Well, it happens. I mean, if people write laws. Yeah, I mean,
is it sort of like the process of saying we're going to write a law and say it's going to be illegal to create a union for these particular workers?
Well, they were a little more careful than saying it's going to be illegal. But what they did was they set up a number of steps that it now takes to legally form a union that make it very difficult. I mean, it's not impossible, but the climb is incredibly higher than it was before 2007. Before 2007, if you wanted to join a union with you and your coworkers, you signed a card, you signed it in secret, you talked to the people that wanted to organize you, got all your questions answered, and, you know, figured out what you wanted to do. And if you decided that you did want to, you signed a card. If you had 50% plus one of the cards signed, you gave them to the labor relations board, and you had a union, and that was called automatic card certification.
Okay.
So it was, you know, still something that did happen, you know, mostly in secret if you could, because as soon as employers find out, you know, they tend to interfere, right? But that was the process, fairly straightforward. And since the new laws come into place, you now have to sign the cards. You still have to do that. But then the labor relations board tells the employer that there's an organizing drive at the workplace. They inform the employer. The employer then has a window of time where they can share their opinions about whether or not they think it's a good idea for you to vote yes. So,
but it's just an opinion.
It's just an opinion. That was another change. But I mean, the reality is, when employers share their opinions about what they think, that has a really intimidating and interfering effect on workers, right? Because most employers aren't running around with an opinion saying, "That's a great idea."
Right.
You know, why don't you
most I don't
join
know any.
Together?
I don't know
yeah.
Any.
No, it just isn't going to happen, right?
Right.
So,
yeah.
And then the other step to that is that then, after there's been this undetermined amount of time that the employer can campaign against the union openly.
And it's indeterminate, is it?
Indeterminate. There's no limit on the time. You then have to have a secret ballot vote on the employer's premises. So you've already voted once with your card. Then there's been this time period where the employer has open season on everyone there. And then you have to go into work one day and vote in front of the boss, basically.
Okay.
So that so in itself is intimidating.
It's not a secret vote. It's not a secret ballot.
It's a secret ballot, so they don't know how you, they won't ever see your ballot.
Right.
But they'll know if you show up for the vote that you voted, right?
Right.
But if you stay home,
yeah,
the employer is going to know how you voted, right?
Incredibly intimidating.
Especially
for people who are making minimum wage.
That's right.
People who have families to support, who are terrified of losing their jobs.
Yes. And if the employer is openly anti-union, I mean, if they're terrified of losing their jobs, they're not going to show up.
Right.
They're not going to show up that day.
And then you run into problems with their coworkers if you're not showing up. I mean, I can see that sort of infighting it in a place of employment. That's a real shame.
Well, it's a little bit of a divide and conquer thing, isn't it,
right,
too?
Because it certainly is.
As long as the employer can share their opinion about whether or not it's a good idea, people are going to be thinking, this isn't worth the hassle. Like, I need to be able to get along with my boss here a little bit, right? Like, I can't afford to lose my job.
Of course.
Our research, like, we filed some lawsuits against the government for this. I mean, this violates people's charter rights, and what's significant is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was unanimously proclaimed by the United Nations for a reason, which provides the freedom of association rights. The evolution of that was a creation of a group called the International Labor Organization from the United Nations, 160 countries represented, and their job was to enforce that part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So, if I can be blunt, I mean, this government, I mean, on this day, citizens in this province need to know that this government does not in any way, shape, or form believe in, support, abide by, respect, or honor that declaration. Since they've come to power, all they've done is illegally violate the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and those things that it stood for. And we took them to the United Nations. Kara and I worked on a submission to the International Labor Organization about what this government's been doing in all these laws. The government, participated in the submission in Geneva, and the ILO came out and condemned them with one of the strongest decisions in ILO history, and required them to fix the problem. In our government, well, I mean, I have to be polite about it, but maybe Kara, you can.
We kind of like politeness on the show.
I mean, but seriously, Kara,
I
mean,
clear, but be polite.
The government's response, does it reflect that they have any respect for why this day exists and why that law exists?
Well, basically, their response when the ILO wrote their decision saying, you violated international law with Bills 5 and 6, they basically thumbed their nose at the ILO and said, well, we don't think it's their best work, and, we don't consider it binding, and they've done nothing to comply with any of the specific requests of the ILO. So one of the specific requests was, you need to fix aspects of the bill. But what you really need to do is sit down with stakeholders, like sit down with workers, and discuss how you're going to fix the mess. And they've refused to do that repeatedly. So, I mean, they basically don't respect the rule of law of the United Nations.
Okay.
One of the other significant things is that in law, our Supreme Court of Canada, and rightfully so, has said that you can measure a democracy and its level of democracy by the level of respect that it has for unions. And history shows that the more respect society has and a government has for working people to collectively have a say in their life, the more free and democratic that society is. And this government, Kara mentioned the two laws, but there's a whole series. I mean, I think there's like five or six where they are just stripping all people of their rights, and therefore undermining our ability to participate in a sort of democratic process or a democratic dialogue or have a voice. I mean, at the end of the day, they're taking away deliberately and intentionally the right of human beings to be human beings and have rights by silencing their voice.
You talked earlier about public consultation, about certain laws being passed, and it seems to be a common thread lately.
Oh, it seems to be, you know, whatever they do, they're just prepared to ram it through without discussing any of the kind of changes they want to make. And if you're going to change laws or bring in new laws that do affect people's fundamental human rights, it's abhorrent that you wouldn't talk to the people about the kind of changes that you have in mind.
Despicable.
It is. And, you know, we live in a democracy, right? We're supposed to be coming about these solutions together through some sort of public, transparent discussion of all the people who will be affected by the changes. And this is a government that doesn't want to consult with anybody. Although, I mean, maybe they do consult with business groups, perhaps, but they sure are not creating an open space for the people to come together and talk about these laws.
They actually have a legal requirement to do that. The United Nations ILO said to them, you must consult meaningfully with the people before you introduce a law, out of respect for the democratic process, and it has to be meaningful. So if they're going to introduce a law that affects women and women's pay, for example, the law, they've been ordered by the ILO to say, okay, talk to the women and hear what their concerns are. Discuss with them what the options are. Talk to other people about it, but be open and transparent about it. Let everybody know before you do anything.
Maybe that's part of the problem, Larry. Maybe the word meaningful is such an debatable word. Whose definition of meaningful are we using here? And perhaps, you know, I just sort of have this picture in my head of a government official saying, well, you know, we contacted somebody from somewhere, some woman, and we talked to her, and so that was consultation. We did it.
Yeah.
Maybe the night before the bill was passed.
Well, one example was when they lowered the minimum age the age that you can legally work in the province, and they did it over the summertime, and they sent out a letter, and I think it went to a few people. You know, the SFL got a letter, and it was, you know, you have 3 weeks to provide us you know, a letter on what your thoughts are or whatever, but we've already passed it, so it's like, we've done it, but now we're going to ask for your feedback, and there's this tiny little feedback window, you know, and so people busily, you know, tried to write down their concerns, but it was already a done deal, and that's not open and transparent.
That's
We have no knowledge of what, say, the business community's point of view was about that. We had no chance to debate as a society what we think about lowering the minimum age, right? And now it's 14,
right,
which is pretty young.
Whatever the definition, this government's action is simple. They're a bully. They don't have any respect for people's voices and views. And their style is, we're doing this to you whether you like it or not. But, you know, if you want to complain about it, we'll listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, you do what I say or not.
So,
and that is what's despicable about their view of consultation. They do not, this government does not believe that people have the right to have a say in what affects their life. That's the bottom line.
Okay. What do we got? About 2 minutes left, Jim?
Not even that.
Okay.
No. We're kind of at the end of the bottle of the hour.
Oh, right.
So we're going to take a break. We'll come back.
Hear some more music.
And, I've got Utah Phillips on tap here. So we'll hear some Utah Phillips before we get going again here.
And
a Joe Hill song, you know. Joe Hill was Utah Phillips' hero. I don't think there's any question about that. I was lucky enough to hear Utah Phillips at a folk festival a few years ago.
Oh, cool.
And he was scheduled to come back, but unfortunately he didn't make it, and now he's gone to, you know, his great reward kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we're going to hear from him in just a minute.
It was Joe Hill's best song. So we almost missed the damn thing. Chorus is, there is power in a band of working folks when we stand hand in hand. That's a power, that's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. I'll teach you the chorus. There is power, there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. Have you got that again? You understand the chorus? Everybody got it now? All right. Oh, would you have freedom from wage slavery and come join the grand industrial band? Oh, would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do you share land to hand? There is power, there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand. Oh, would you have mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack that's away in the back? Or would you have wings up in heaven to fly and start here with a rack on your back? But there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand. Oh, if you like sluggers to feed in your head, don't organize, all union despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. But there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand. So come all ye workers from every land and come join the grand industrial band. Then we our share of this earth shall demand. Come on, do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand.
Okay, Utah Phillips singing Joe Hill's tune Power in the Union. And we are with Cara Banks, Executive Assistant to the Saskatchewan Federation of Labor, and Larry Kowalchuk, lawyer for the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union. And we're talking about the Federation of SASC, Federation of Labor's Labor Rights, our Human Rights Campaign, and various other things. And Mona, what else?
Take it away.
Sure.
I have a message for Sandra. Sandra, this is Mona Hill and Jim Hutchings on Human Rights Radio. We're in our second half, and we're talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Human Rights Day. So let's get back to it. Earlier, you talked about the ILO and the directives to the Saskatchewan government to fix this problem. And could you just sort of give us a quick sort of overview of what that problem was and what's going on with it, and what are we looking for in the future in regarding to this problem?
The ILO requested the government to do five things. They made five requests. Like Cara pointed out, they were to change laws, remove some laws, change some of the decision makers, and the government ignores them, basically has ignored them. So we recently, the ILO has wanted us to update them. We just sent an update to them basically saying the government has ignored what you've asked them to do. And so we've said two things. And there's two consequences for them, the government and therefore the people of Saskatchewan.
Can I just backtrack for 1 second, maybe just for listeners who aren't aware of what the ILO is?
Okay. The ILO is part of the United Nations, and it was set up to deal with the employment relationship in the world that was emerging, as Cara used the word, capitalism. And so business representatives, government representatives, and labor representatives are represented in the ILO. It's a tripartite body. There's 56 members on the governing body of the ILO from 160 countries. 28 are representatives of government, 14 are representatives of business, and 14 are representatives of labor. And they sit and they hear what, you know, what's going on in a complaint, and then they make a decision. And what's significant is that decision has to be unanimous. Like, they all have to agree on every word because it impacts the world. Sounds silly, but it impacts the whole world. It impacts all
That's
government.
That's incredible power.
And so they have to agree on every word, and they did in this case.
And this case is?
It's a case filed by the Saskatchewan Federation of Labor together with a bunch of unions and groups saying that the Public Service Essential Services Act, which takes away the right to strike for most public servants, the Trade Union Act amendments that make it hard to get a union, the Trespass to Property Act, which takes away the right of all citizens in Saskatchewan to march, demonstrate, protest, or whatever. They said those laws are unacceptable. They said we want you to change them. And not only do we want you to change them, we want you to fix some of the harm that you've caused to the people that have been affected. And we want you to sit down, like Cara explained, with the unions. So the Federation of Labor won its complaint with the ILO. So now we've gone back to the ILO and said, look, they're ignoring you. I mean, they're ignoring you. On this day, citizens should be concerned about that. And so we've said, well, they've ignored you, so, and things have gotten worse. So they could go as far, they haven't ever done this, but they could go as far as going to the United Nations and asking the United Nations to put sanctions against Canada. So that's what the Federation of Labor and groups are doing. The other thing is that we're in court.
Okay.
We filed a lawsuit against the government on the same things. And under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is freedom, the same freedom of association rights.
Right.
That are in the
and that's the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, right?
And the Supreme Court has said that when we're interpreting those three words, those wonderful fundamental rights, freedom of association, we should be at minimum accepting what the UN and the ILO say those words mean. Because if they mean that for the whole world, they should at least mean that for us. So since we've won at the ILO, we're in court saying, well, they're ignoring. And, I mean, you want to explain what happened in B.C. when the government did that?
Well, in B.C. they had a series of laws that basically tore up workers' collective agreements. And so there was an ILO complaint filed by the unions there, and they won that. They also went to court with the ILO win in their pocket, and the B.C. government ended up having to negotiate a giant settlement of like $93 million for the workers for having violated their rights. So we're hoping that when we get to court, which will be next year, with our ILO win in our pocket and all of our arguments about the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, that we'll have similar success, we're hoping. But, you know, in the meantime, because legal processes can take a very long time, you know, and it's probably going to go through several levels of courts, you know, before this all gets solved. And you just never know for sure about a victory at the end of the day. We're hoping. But what we're really doing in the meantime is spending time with union members talking about the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And we've done, I don't know how many now, hundreds of educationals about this, where we ask people to open up the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms and look at what their fundamental freedoms are. And it's really surprising how many workers have never read it.
Right.
And have never talked
about
it.
Well, I think the average Canadian citizen has never read it.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I read it was because I took a political science class on the charter, right? Because I went and did a degree in political science. But, right. I mean, I don't know that I would have read it before that either. Mm-hmm. And so it's been awesome to have workers learn about what their fundamental freedoms are. And then, of course, when we then take them through the different laws that have been passed here, and we ask them, do you think that these are a violation of your charter rights? And you know what? They agree. They really do. You know, even without having any legal training or whatever, the writing is on the wall, you know, and I think the government's testing as to whether or not they can get away with it. So the educational part of the campaign is really the exciting part, I think. I was glad that you brought up the article that talked about Eleanor Roosevelt and mm-hmm. the role that trade unions played in the Universal Declaration of Human
right,
Rights.
I thought it was so significant.
It is. And I don't think very many people realize the role that labor has played in some of those, you know, huge human rights sort of advances.
Right.
And I think a lot of workers, when they think of human rights, they probably think of things like Amnesty International, and they maybe think about your rights, you know, not to be tortured or to be detained or around things like arrests. Yeah. And I think there maybe is another subset of people that think about the right to housing or maybe mm-hmm. water or food. Mm-hmm. But I don't think very many people realize that labor rights are human rights.
I think you're right.
So that's been kind of our big message. And, you know, we're hoping that regardless of what happens in the courts, because mm-hmm. that's a particular process, that workers will demand their rights in all the other ways that they can, right? And mm-hmm. and there's other ways, like, for example, you could elect a government that doesn't violate your rights or that would restore your rights
mm-hmm.
for you. You know, there's other options. So that's been an exciting part.
Wow. What about the schools? Are you going into the schools? Larry, it seems to me that at some point recently you and I had a conversation where you mentioned having something like this in the schools, in high school maybe.
We have done some presentations at university classes on this.
Okay.
And again, Cara's explanation of the presentations is we don't go out and tell people what to think and do. What we do is say, here, did you know this?
Mm-hmm.
And let people look at it and realize, oh, my God, I didn't know I had these rights. And so then, you know, they can do what they want. But the Federation of Labor, I mean, Carr can talk about this as well. The labor movement forever has wanted the school system, has made proposals to the school systems, high schools, so on. I mean, I've done a couple of talks on the right of young women not to be sexually harassed in school. But you know, that's through a public legal education. But we have been asking forever. I mean, these young people are going to come out into the world. Why don't they know their rights? Like, you don't have to tell them to join a union. You don't have to tell them to, you know, how to vote. You don't have to tell them to organize. You don't have to tell them to be radicals. But we don't even show young people the respect of reading their own rights. And so for anyone listening out there, I mean, phone the Federation of Labor office. And, you know, we can come out to any school, any community group, any organization, and give you the documents and let you learn for yourself what your rights are, right?
Well, and the Federation of Labor does have one program. It's called the Ready for Work program. And trade unionists go into high schools and they mm-hmm. talk to young people about some of their basic rights, mostly about health and safety mm-hmm. rights when they enter the workplace, but also about basic labor standards. And it's great. And, I mean, trade unionists love doing it, but it's not mandatory. You know, it's not a mandatory right. part of any curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't reach enough young people for sure. We're glad that we have that one sort of entrance into high schools, but, you know, we don't write the curriculum either. So
right.
I would love to see that be a mandatory aspect of every school.
They used to have civics classes in high school. Do they do that anymore?
Well, they have social studies classes, but,
okay.
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not sure what's contained in that curriculum,
right.
but I bet you that I doubt that they spend a lot of time on the charter. I doubt that they spend a lot of time on fundamental human rights.
What freedoms do we enjoy today in Canada as a result of unions and the labor movement? One that crosses my mind might be pension plans.
One of the things we ask people to do is to close their eyes, particularly union members and new people who haven't been around, to close your eyes and imagine what Saskatchewan would be like if there was no SAS Power, no SASK Energy, no SaskTel, Crown Corporations, owned by the people. Imagine what it would be like if you still had a 12-hour day. Imagine if you still had child labor, required to work at age 12. No minimum wage. No stat holidays. No days off to be with your family. No maternity leave. Well, you keep going.
Employment insurance, public pensions, Medicare. All of those things were things that unions were instrumental in Saskatchewan in bringing about. I mean, with other groups too, other progressive groups. But unions helped create the space to demand those things. And sometimes they did it incrementally, right? Like one shop would gain that right and it would spread. And eventually, if enough unionized people have a benefit, it becomes something that everyone can have. So, like 3 weeks holidays, mm-hmm. you know, you wouldn't have 3 weeks holidays if it wasn't for unions.
You know, this might be, you know, not well known as well, but the labor movement doesn't just exist, obviously, in Saskatchewan or Canada. It exists all over the world.
Right.
And, you know, there are moments in history when there's a call that goes out, where there's a nasty government dictator like Hitler or
apartheid in South Africa.
Apartheid in South
Africa.
That's a
good example.
Yeah. And unions and their members are usually the first on the line. Always have been. Because it's an international obligation and an international right to say to power that's abusing people, you can't do that. And you will find the labor movement either there on the front line or behind the scenes giving people the support so that they can defend themselves against this.
And sometimes it's financial solidarity and sometimes it's boycotts. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways that you can show your solidarity.
And I see as a burst to that would be they would be the first targets of oppressive regimes and oppressive governments.
For that very reason.
Absolutely.
For that very reason. And that's why it's not a coincidence here in Saskatchewan that they have spent the majority of their legislative policies, which include laws, to go after the unions. I mean, John Gormley, was it on the premier? Can't remember, was declared on the, they're going to declare war on?
Oh, he said something. So are you going to declare war on unions? And Brad Walz said, yeah, basically. He agreed with John Gormley that that's what he was going to do.
Before he was elected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. one thing that you can say about Brad Walz on this topic, he kept his word. And he's declared war, which is, I mean, you know, from the legal perspective, like Cara was explaining everything, I find it depressing and disappointing. I mean, I understand it with employers and stuff or honest disagreements, but a government that's already been told that you're violating people's international human rights, why do we as citizens have to spend a single second of time saying to our leaders, whose job it is to promote the law, why do we have to take them to court and fight with them about their obligation to respect at least the law, whether they agree with it or not?
Right.
They're lawbreakers. It's disappointing. It's discouraging.
Yeah. Well, and there's also a number of other policies that aren't necessarily just laws, but, you know, things that we've been seeing happen, like, you know, when they took back the funding that they had promised to Station 20 West, you know, that's a couple of years ago now.
In Saskatoon,
yeah. You know, one of the most important community development projects that are, you know, really have human rights in mind in terms of helping out like a core community become self-sufficient and have all the health care and food needs, food security and all those things. You know, one of the first things they did too was retract that money, right? And now they're talking about shutting down the Welfare Rights Center. They've cut...
Which they did because it was unionized for the first time.
Right. There was a union forming there and they didn't like that. And, you know, they've cut some, there's been some cuts to child care grants and all, there's kind of a growing list, too, of just, it's not necessarily like new laws, but it's how they're spending the money, right?
Okay.
What they're doing with taxpayer dollars. And that sends a pretty clear message, too. Like when the Welfare Rights Center, who services the people who are probably the most vulnerable or some of the most vulnerable people in Saskatchewan, and who are frontline advocates for those people and really their survival at the end of the day, to cut that because a union was forming there, and I don't know what their other justifications are, but it's clear that that was one of the reasons. Doesn't that send a message about what kind of values this government has?
Well, it does. It is concerning about how they value the marginalized people in our province. It is very concerning.
It's very concerning. And I think that this pattern is getting deeper and deeper. And, you know, I hope that as we roll into an election next year, that all of these issues are front and center. Like, I hope that there's a good public debate about this.
Right.
We need it.
Well, we want people to remember. We want people to remember when the government changed. Last time people, you know, they had a government for 16 years of a certain political party, and they wanted a fresh face, and they got one.
Yeah.
They wanted to give the new guy a chance.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he's had his chance. This time around, look at what they've done, and remember that. Cara sort of briefly touched on it, but, I mean, this is International Human Rights Day. You can pick on unions if people listening don't believe us about the role of unions and why they're targeting them. Well, how about if we pick the Human Rights Commission itself, which happens to be clearly an organization that's there to promote the human rights of all citizens, particularly vulnerable. What's the government's latest bill, Cara? 160. What are they doing with that?
Bill 160, which was introduced 10 days ago now into the legislature. They're amending the Human Rights Code. And they're making a number of changes to the Human Rights Code, which is a show in itself, so you'll have to invite good folks back to talk about it. But basically, they're going to scrap the human rights tribunals that are set up under the Human Rights Code for people's complaints to be heard in an accessible and ideally timely way. So what we have is, you know, a series of governments who have totally underfunded the Human Rights Commission to the point that, you know, there's a lot of frustration with people who have made complaints, but it is there for the people, right? It is there for that reason. And we're still getting our head around what these amendments will mean.
And we probably will do a show based on, you know, what that's all about as well, I think, in the near future.
And, I mean, our Human Rights Code contains the same things as our Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's the same basic fundamental set of rights, and this is another kick at the can that they're going to take to roll those back.
Well, I think probably we could do a whole week's worth of shows on this issue and these avalanche of issues. We're going to wrap up shortly. And before we go, I'd like to give you an opportunity to just sort of spend a minute talking about what's important to you in terms of the labor movement. What people in the public can do to protect their human rights as far as labor goes and the violations that have been occurring. And then we're going to talk about what's happening tonight in Regina at the Cathedral Neighborhood Center and Amnesty International's event. So take it away.
Okay, well, I guess my closing thought is it's a mistake to think that unions are something separate from the people or that they're separate from community because they're not, right? There's probably about 125,000 union members in the province, right? And they all have families and neighbors and communities. So even if you don't belong to a union yourself right now, you know, someone in your, people you love do, right? We're all connected. And so, I guess I would just invite people not to allow themselves to be divided that way, and to know that, you know, really what we need is a good public discussion, community after community, to talk about what it means to roll back union rights, because it means a whole lot more than an attack on one individual's right. It really is an attack on our democracy. So to me, the main thing is that we have these conversations, union, non-union, across the province, and just build that space so that we can hopefully take our democracy back.
Thank you.
I would simply say on this day, International Human Rights Day, in recognition of all that, the reason for unions is to give you the ability to have those rights and exercise them. And there is so much going on that's wrong in Canada and in Saskatchewan. And I want to encourage people not only to you know, do what Cara is saying, but why aren't you exercising your rights out there, people? You have the right to protest, demonstrate, march. There's unacceptable stuff that is going to impact your life, your children, forever. So stand up for your rights, because if you don't use them,
you'll lose them.
You'll lose them.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Cara. How much time, Jim?
Less than two.
Okay, let's do this. Tonight at the Cathedral Neighborhood Center, we're going to be celebrating the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and International Human Rights Day. Come out at 7 o'clock. Our campaign is a letter-writing campaign, and it's called Write for Rights, and you can get to write a letter to help someone's life, perhaps get them out of prison, help them to enjoy the human rights that we enjoy as well. We're going to be celebrating with some of Regina's most exciting musicians and activists, Ink Road, Devin Floyd, Reagan Hinchcliffe, the Local Onlys. It's an all-ages event. And, we have cake. You have to come and have cake. We're picking it up this afternoon. It's going to be a fun night. Come on out to the Cathedral Neighborhood Center on 13th Avenue in Regina and celebrate with Amnesty International. Oh, and by the way, the admission is free, and we do gladly take donations. Thank you very much for today, and we'll be back again next week.
Every day and every moment in every corner of the world, injustice cries out for your intervention. No one individual can respond to all the problems of the world, of course. To paraphrase a great humanitarian, if you can't help everybody, just help one. And whether the abuses stop immediately or take a long time to end, the gift of your attention and intervention can make a profound and positive impact on the ability of individuals and communities to endure and prevail. Our founder, Peter Benenson, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."